serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to learn about one of San Diego's hidden gems, the Flying Leathernecks Aviation Museum at Marine Corps Air Station Miramar. Yes, it's open to the public and admission is free. It's closed on Mondays and on federal holidays. Visit any other day between the hours of 9 and 3:30 and you'll find dozens of historic planes and helicopters and learn the history of some of the people who have flown them. I'll tell you right now, we're going to have to continue into our next episode with 96-year-old retired Major Glenn Ferguson, because his fascinating quarter century in the Marine Corps is not going to fit into these final 15 minutes. Next time, you'll hear about the duties he had in very close proximity to Presidents Franklin D. Roosevelt and Dwight D. Eisenhower, as well as how he became a pioneering helicopter pilot. But Glenn's Semper Fi story goes way back to before World War II and back to the Midwest where he was born.
I was born in Chicago and eventually, we moved to different places, but eventually wound up in Harvey, Illinois, which is where I lived when I signed up to the Marine Corps in 1939. Then we were given tickets and caught a train from Chicago out to San Diego. In those days, you were supposed to go to the Paris Island if you were east of the Mississippi, but they needed people out west, so we were lucky. I didn't have to contend with the sand fleas at Paris Island and went out to San Diego boot camp in 1939.
You know, you skipped right ahead there to joining the Marine Corps in 1939, but I'm interested in that childhood in Chicago because you've got Hack Wilson and Charlie Grimm and the Cubs going on. You got Al Capone up to his business on the west side of Chicago. What do you remember about those days?
We lived in I remember one period where we lived in an apartment that was just two blocks from Al Capone's mother. And every once in a while, the big black cars would circle around, checking to make sure that nobody was in that neighborhood that would bother his mother. We had exposure to him in that way.
I guess so. And do you remember as a child having any of these dreams or ambitions of, hey, when I grow up, here's what I want to do with my life?
When I was pretty young, I started building model airplanes, and I always wanted to join the Army Air Force and go to Randolph Field. Eventually, it converted to joining the Marine Corps, because later when I was in the Marine Corps, I wanted to join naval aviation rather than going back to Army aviation.
But as a 17, 18-year-old kid, were you ready for the Marine Corps, or was that a rude awakening?
No. Because my father had been in the Marine Corps in World War I, and in between the wars, he was in the field artillery. So I'd always been around the military.
You mentioned your father being in World War I as a Marine. So he was part of what they called the old breed?
Yeah, the old breed. I was the old breed. He was the old breed.
Did he tell you any stories about what he did in
the Marines? No, and that's why I finally decided to talk to my kids and eventually got into the business of writing my memoirs, because I knew nothing about what he had done. He'd been to France. Well, his commanding officer in France was Captain Vogel, who later was Brigadier General Vogel, who signed my first PFC warrant in San Diego. And he told me to go up and say hi to the old man. Now, you can imagine a boot fresh out of boot camp going up and knocking on the general's door. No way. So, anyhow, that's one of the oddities. We did have that connection. But that's the only thing I ever knew about it. He had a pretty bad childhood life and eventually got into the Corps. It apparently did him a lot of good, just like it did me.
Did you start to see the good it was doing you early on, or did you have some challenges there in your early Marine Corps days?
No, surprisingly, when I graduated from boot camp, I was made a gunner. I joined Dell Company 6 Marines, which is a machine gun company, which supports the rifle companies A, B, and C, Abel, Baker, and Charlie. As a gunner, that meant the rest of the squad had to support me. They got my ammunition. I had an assistant gunner that hung the box of ammunition on the side of the gun. He carried the gun. I carried the tripod when we went into combat or So right from the beginning, I was kind of singled out. You kind of feel that it's been pretty much that way the rest of my career because of the steps that I took initially. They paid off later. Each step seemed to precede the next one in a good manner.
And so this is all before World War II began for
America. Oh, yes, yes.
Did you anticipate getting into combat? I mean, you joined up in 1939. Did you see the war coming?
Well, I could tell a story about that.
All right. Please do.
One day we fell out for inspection by General Vogel. Before he trooped the line, I looked up and saw a plane flying over and decided I was going to fly. I didn't care how or what was going to happen, but I was going to fly. So that Monday, I went into the office and asked them what I had to do. In order to fly, I had to, at that time, you had to have a degree, college degree, in order to get into flight training. So in order to get a college degree, I had to go to the Naval Academy. In order to go to the Naval Academy, I had to go to the Naval Academy Prep School. In order to go to the Naval Academy Prep School, I had to go to sea duty. In order to go to sea duty, I supposedly had to go to the sea duty school there in San Diego. But they skipped that and sent me directly aboard ship. So I took a stripe with me because I was promoted in 3 months. Back in those days, you got a promotion every time you shipped over. So that was pretty quick. Anyhow, I was aboard ship. Before the war, before I left the ship, we had fallen out one day to stand for a dignitary coming aboard. And the sergeant said, "You fellas better pay attention. You better learn quick because the whores in Panama said we're going to war, and they're never wrong." So that's how we knew we were going to war.
Now, that's an intelligent source I haven't heard a lot about before.
Well, that's where we got our information.
And how long before Pearl Harbor was that?
Well, that was several months before.
Uh-huh.
I left the ship in September before the attack in December.
And what kind of ship were you on?
A battleship, the Tennessee.
You're on the USS Tennessee.
Yeah, I was initially, because I went aboard with a stripe, the first sergeant was quite disgruntled because at that time they were promoting faster aboard ship than they were on the beach, and what they called saltwater warrants. So when you left the ship, you had to give up a stripe in order to keep things balanced between sea duty and shore duty. I went aboard with a stripe and then, of course, took off from there. Eventually, I made sergeant. When I went aboard, because he was disgruntled about me going aboard with a stripe, I don't know. I wound up, the Tennessee was experimenting with the Marines, the only ship in the Navy that was doing it, but they were experimenting with the Marines, and he put me in charge of the Powder Monkeys. It's on number 3 turret. That's down below in the bottom of the ship where they have the powder bags for the big guns. And the powder bags are sent up by elevator to the big guns, which can fire 35,000 yards or something. That was my start aboard ship, kind of under the gun. But it was good in that they were watching me. They expected me to foul up like some others had. I performed the way I was supposed to, made my men perform properly. And they soon took me out and made me a gun captain on the 3-inch 50 anti-aircraft guns. And I was the gun captain just for a short while on that. And then they made me a gun captain on the 5-inch 51 guns, which are traditional Marine assignment.
Well, there's a big question you didn't answer there. When you heard that intelligence that those wise sages down in Panama were saying that you were going to war, did it sink in for you? Did you believe it, or did you just take it with a grain of salt?
We all just, you know, we're Marines. We do what we're told. Mm-hmm. So it didn't mean anything outstanding to us. If we're going to war, we're going to war. I don't know. I don't remember any reaction by anybody other than we were in ranks waiting for the VIP to come aboard. He told us, and so that was it. He told us.
So then 3 months later, it actually happens. Where were you on December 7th?
At that time, I had already been shipped back to the state to go to the Naval Academy Prep School in preparation to going to the Naval Academy. The ship was at Pearl Harbor. They had six quays that they tied up the battle wagons to it. And because that wasn't enough, they tied them up two to a quay. And the Tennessee tied up inbound the Wevie, which...
The West Virginia.
West Virginia.
Yeah.
And so it took most of the hits from the Japanese. We did get some damage on the Tennessee, but it wasn't enough to stop it. It went back to the States and got redone and fitted out again and went back out to war because it was protected by the other ship on the inner side of the bay.
I've talked to a vet right here in San Diego who was on the West Virginia and had to escape to the Tennessee in a pretty unique fashion on December 7th. I'm sure he'd love to talk to you, Stu Headley, sometime. But so I'm just thinking about you. You're at the Naval Academy Prep School on the day the Pacific Fleet is decimated, and the ship you were just on a few months ago is right in the middle of it. So what was that like for you to be so far away and get that news?
That night, the skipper of the station ordered everybody out on the campus. We were in a school area where they had buildings that were devoted to schools. They were around a campus such as you'd normally see, and they ordered everybody out of the barracks onto the campus. And I thought to myself, this is the most stupid order I ever heard, because if they were to bomb us, which is what that was for, to get us out of the barracks in case we were bombed, if they were to bomb us, they would have wiped out the future of the fleet. If they were successful in getting a submarine up the river and shelled us that way, that was the same thing. It was going to wipe out the elite people of the fleet that were coming up in the fleet. So this is a bummer.
And I've never spoken to anyone who was in Annapolis at that time.
No, not in Annapolis. This was Norfolk.
Prep school
in Norfolk. And now they moved the school, but back in those days it was at Norfolk.
So there was this idea that there could be an attack.
Norfolk
right there
is a big naval base, and they were afraid that there would be some attempt to do something to the base. That's what the skipper, that was, and he was right to take defensive action, but not that one. Putting all the elite together in a campus like that, one bomb could have really ruined the future of the Navy. So anyhow, I decided that the next day that I would resign from the school and go back to the Corps, because it was my thought that they're going to need a lot of pilots in a hurry. They're not going to need me to go to the academy, that I can get in a lot faster. And events proved me right. The class that I was in that went on to the academy was promised by the naval people that they could get into flight training after they graduated. But after they graduated, they said, no, you have to go out and fight the war. And so for 3 years, they were out with the fleet. And then later, when I went to school at Corpus Christi to learn to become an instrument instructor, I had quite a bit of flight time by that time and was a captain. And my old class was across the field from me getting washed out. They brought them back. They were in flight training, as they promised, but they didn't need any more pilots because they had too many, and they were washing them out. Now you can imagine what that did to their careers. So there were some bitter men over that.
Timing is everything.
Yeah.
So you sensed that coming.
Well, I knew enough about the politics in Washington to know that that wasn't the way for me. So like I said, I volunteered, and they sent me to 8th and I Barracks. I went back to the Marine Corps then. That's where they make all the special assignments for the Marine Corps. For example, guard courier trips. When they developed the radar, it was secret.
Right.
And so they would ship the radar from the factory where they made it down to Norfolk to put aboard ship. And I was on one of those details to start with.
You were protecting this secret cargo, making sure it reached its destination.
Yeah, to get to Norfolk. It was by railroad. Whenever we stopped, we had a second caboose that was attached to the train. And whenever the train stopped, we got out and surrounded the train to prevent anybody from getting to it. And so when we got to the bay in Norfolk, I went up to the tower. They had a bridge across the barge. They rented all the cars on the barge. And then I went up to the bridge to talk to the captain. He wanted me to steer just have fun steering the barge. But it didn't have a central location on the wheel, the big wheel that you see on the ships. And I didn't know where center point was. So I was oversteering. Pretty soon that thing was bobbing. I decided, this is a lot of weight to be bobbing in the ground, in the water. And so I said, you better take over. And he laughed and took over. Then the next one was a guard courier, just like in what you read in the books, where they send an officer out from Washington, D.C. across country with a briefcase full of secret papers. We got aboard the train in Washington. When we would get into our compartment, we would lock it. When we pulled out, I went up and got the porter and asked him to drop the upper bunk in our compartment, and he said he'd be back in a few minutes. So when he came back and knocked on the door, I had the lieutenant stand in the corner so that he wouldn't be in a line of fire, and then I stood across from the door with my .45 pointed right at his head. And he opened the door and saw that .45. He turned white.
Oh, man.
He backed out, and he never would come back again. He got another young fellow to take care of us.
And who could blame him? Real cloak and dagger stuff there. But I know the variety and intrigue of your different Marine Corps duties would only intensify from there. And I can't wait to hear about all of that next time on Hometown Heroes, from being there in the infancy of what we know now as Camp David, to serving in the Roosevelt White House, to evacuating the wounded overseas, and eventually flying President Eisenhower around the world in helicopters. There is so much more to explore with Glenn Ferguson. I think you're also going to really enjoy the story of the unique award he helped launch here at the Flying Leathernecks Aviation Museum, honoring a group of people who are so crucial to the Marine Corps, but who so often get overlooked. So don't miss those stories and more next time, and don't forget to explore more about the museum online at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening to the program today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.